welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And we're back talking about something that doesn't get into the news as much as it should be. And I'm referring to Iraq and what's going on there. And who better to talk about it than someone who spent a good deal of time there, was back again a couple of months ago, and I'm referring to Dodger Mail. March 2003, we all remember that. My goodness, over 6 years and counting, and the war still goes on. It cooled down a while. It's been heating back up again. Dar covers it regularly on his website, Dodger Mail's Mideast Dispatches. Oh, I think listeners know who Dar is, but for the few who may not, he's an activist. He's an independent award-winning journalist. He reported unembedded from Iraq for 8 months between 2003-2005. He's the author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. And Dar has a brand new book out. It's called Military Resistors, Soldiers Who Refused to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, they have a road to hoe to manage to do that, but the law is on their side, because even in the Army manual 2710, I believe it is, it says specifically that soldiers all the way up the chain of command have a legal duty to obey illegal orders. They have a legal duty to obey this illegal orders. Well, run that past the court that tries to court-martial you. Anyway, some make it, some don't. But, Dar, it's great having you back on the program again to update listeners on what's going on in Iraq.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's terrific, Dar. You write all the time, and you've written recently about something that I think is very, very important. We bought off the Sunni militia for a while. We paid off the fighters about $300 a month. And then what we did what we usually do. We betrayed them and just started paying, I guess, leaders, but not paying the rank and file. 100,000 strong, the Sawa Sunni militia, if I'm pronouncing it right, Sons of Iraq, and they're leaving. They're deserting. They want nothing to do with this, and the violence is picking up again. Talk about what's going on now.
Well, that's the context of what we're looking at, where the Sawa, which the U.S. paid off to basically, they paid them off for two reasons. One, so that they would stop attacking the Americans, because even according to the military, the vast majority of the people in the Sawa are former resistance fighters. The second main reason the U.S. hired them was and created that militia was to control al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was responsible for most of the massive bombings that we were seeing, these big indiscriminate bombings that were usually done in Shia marketplaces that were killing massive numbers of people. And the Sawa were very effective at this, because even according to the military, the Iraqi resistance was actually engaged in fighting al-Qaeda long before the Sawa were even formed. So they were obviously, being Iraqis, much better equipped at finding al-Qaeda and eliminating them. And so they were very effective when they got U.S. backing and funding to start doing that en masse across the country. And they did a very good job of it, and that's why we saw a very, very clear sign that the al-Qaeda was basically being taken out enough that they were unable to carry out their attacks. But now we're seeing that change as the Sawa are being taken out. They're being not being paid. They're walking away from their security posts, and now we're seeing an increase in these attacks again.
Yeah, that music means we need to take a break. Let's do that.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Talking about conditions in Iraq. Just a quick aside, I haven't seen numbers lately, but I do believe that the cost of the Iraq war in inflation-adjusted dollars is fast approaching the cost of the Vietnam War. It went on for so many years. And I guess the only other war to shoot for after that is World War II in inflation-adjusted dollars. And there's no question that many, many more billions of dollars, tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions, are going to be poured down a rat hole fighting this war that won't end until the Iraqi resistance finally drives us out. And all, and so many more people will be killed and harmed and the rest of it, with Iraq already absolutely devastated by six-plus years of fighting and the sanctions that preceded it.
That's true. We're looking at, again, an increase where the level of violence across the country is going back up and slowly getting back into levels that we were seeing a couple of years ago, which at the time was being referred to with words like apocalyptic, even in much of the mainstream media here. But now, since it's below those levels, unless we see a huge attack where unbelievable numbers of Iraqis are killed or a large number of U.S. soldiers are killed in one go, it's just not making the media, and it's really astounding because already this month we've had more troops that have been killed in Iraq in 1 month period since last September of last year. So, and the same can be said in a corollary way of the numbers of Iraqis being killed, just consistently increasing numbers. But since people have become apparently so desensitized to it, it's just not making the news.
Or does it make the news? And even Afghanistan, that makes a little bit more news. But some of the major media headlines, they read like a fiction writer wrote them. Things like if we can't wrap this up in the next year and a half, whatever, the U.S. public no longer will support us. I just can't imagine anybody supporting anything like this. I think the real situation is people don't understand what's going on, let alone the reasons why, and they go about their lives and they're oblivious to what's happening halfway across the world. But we've got two illegal wars going on, two brutal occupations. There is a lot of killing going on in both countries every single day, and as you say, it barely gets any mention in the major media, and people don't know. And I guess that's the way it's planned. Keep people uninformed so all these horrors can go on, unreported, unseen, unknown, except for the work that you do. And we'll discuss in programs like this.
That's right. And that's why it's just important, I think, you know, regardless of what the corporate media is doing, that we have to keep reporting on both of these occupations because both of them are getting worse, Afghanistan more so right now, so it's getting a little bit more attention, but it is really critical that we keep reporting on these. And the reality is they're not going to go away because anyone who is familiar with U.S. foreign policy knows that despite all the rhetoric of change, of course, the Obama administration is not doing anything, not even coming close either in Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, both these occupations are here to stay. There's U.S. bases that are in each place that are permanent. We're looking at a massive increase in the number of troops in Afghanistan. And thus far, despite all of this rhetoric of withdrawal from Iraq, we've actually seen that the troop numbers there remain consistent. There has not been anyone leave Iraq. We're still looking at 139,000 U.S. soldiers in Iraq and over 200,000 private contractors.
That private contractors number is really astonishing. How many people know that? A lot of them are workers. They're not all Blackwater forces. Is Blackwater still there, by the way?
Well, they technically have their contract was allowed to expire, but most of their workers simply shifted over to working for other contracting companies like DynCorp. So technically, they're not there, but in reality, on the ground, most of their people are still there.
And they have a new name now, right?
Right. It's called Z, which is the pronunciation of, at least according to them, the letters XE, which is the way they've rebranded their company.
Oh, my goodness. It's like calling a serial killer the Tooth Fairy or something like that. really ugly. Yeah, when your name gets too ugly to be mentioned in public, well, you just change your name, and people don't realize that the new name refers to the old organization, but they still do the same thing, and they're just a bunch of hired thugs.
Exactly, you know, and it's really, you know, this hasn't fooled anyone. I mean, if anything, the rebranding effort has drawn even more attention to the company. It's simply not covering up anything. Of course, as scandal after scandal continues to come out, including the recent situation where it came to light that Blackwater was operating in Iraq with illegal weapons as well.
Oh, well, I guess that doesn't make any difference for a nation that uses illegal weapons. We try them out in real time, Dar. Things like white phosphorus and all the other stuff that we've used over the years. We still use depleted uranium weapons routinely that really has irradiated vast swaths of the country, including Afghanistan. And I mean, this began years ago, before the Gulf War. I think the first time depleted uranium weapons were used were back in the 1970s. We had Israel try them out for us. It might have been in the so-called Yom Kippur War, 1973, testing them in real time, which is what the Pentagon does. By the way, we're getting to be more and more the Lone Ranger in both countries as more countries pull out their forces, including the Brits. Do the Brits still have any forces left in the Basra area? I know they want to pull out. Have they pulled them all out at this point?
They've pulled out most. They are going to keep some there. I think the last number I saw was around 450 so-called advisors. But as far as the brunt of their combat troops, and the brunt of all their troops, for that matter, they are pulling just about all of them out. But they do have a good, you know, several hundred that will remain there, it's looking like indefinitely. And this has had an immediate impact on the occupation insofar as now that the Brits are pulling out, we now see American military being forced to fill those positions in the south. They are still running patrols down there, and that's why we've seen, even in just the last few weeks, the number of attacks on Americans has increased across the country, and particularly in the south, A, because the Americans weren't even there for a long time, because that's where the so-called multinational forces were in charge of security. But now the Americans are having to step in, so they're having to take shots, and actually in just the last few weeks we've seen several American soldiers killed there.
And the multinational forces are slowly pulling out, I guess, incrementally. And I think especially in Afghanistan there, where we put out the call for other countries to supply forces, NATO countries, whatever, and there's a great reluctance to go in there. They have no dog in that fight. They really have no dog in the Iraq fight either, but some of them went in. And apparently we will end up the Lone Ranger in both countries. And I think if listeners want to know what our plans are, for Afghanistan and Iraq, think South Korea. We went in there in 1950, and we ain't left since. And I think that's the plan for Iraq. As long as there's any oil under the Iraqi sand, and as long as the Caspian Sea area is very rich in oil and gas, then we will not leave Afghanistan. So we're there for the duration. And Afghanistan, I think, means more than that, too. We're also surrounding Russia with military bases in China for the great battle for Eurasia that includes the Middle East there. This great treasure that we've talked about briefly on this program that extends from Germany and Poland in the east, according to Zbigniew Brzezinski, all the way to the Pacific, China and Russia, and the Middle East and the Indian subcontinent. And we consider that the grandest of grand prizes. So we have a new great game going on for that part of the world, and the Russians know it, and the Chinese know it, and there'll be a lot of ugliness, I think, coming up. But heaven help us if it gets more than just rhetoric and economic warfare or whatever. But there's always a chance that somebody will do something by mistake, and you've got two nuclear superpowers. Against each other, and we nearly had a major catastrophe back during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we're putting offensive so-called missile defense into Poland. You know about that, and missile tracking radar into the Czech Republic, and if either side makes a mistake and thinks there's some kind of an aggressive act by the other. And we could have a real bad situation on our hands. So that's going on. And plus the occupations continue. Also, it's heating up in the Fallujah area, too.
It's true. Even just a few days ago, actually, we saw an attack on American an American convoy there that killed three Americans. At least one of them was a soldier, one of them was a so-called diplomat, and I believe the third was a contractor, if I recall correctly. But there are actually attacks every single day in Fallujah now, either on American or Iraqi collaborator security forces. And so it's a situation where slowly but surely in all of the areas where the SAWA were maintaining control that we were talking about earlier, as they're walking off their post or literally quitting and going back into the resistance from which they came, of course we're going to see a slow but steady increase again in attacks against American forces in these areas. This is what was threatened by SAWA commanders as month after month went by with these people not being paid and continuing to be betrayed by both American and Iraqi forces who had promised to give them positions in the Iraqi government as far as working in security, and instead they're being attacked and not being paid. And so they're walking off their posts, and so again we're seeing actually rather abrupt increase in the number of al-Qaeda attacks across the country, and then also we're seeing a slow but steady increase once again as the Iraqi resistance starts to reformulate itself and attack occupation forces once again. And so Fallujah, this recent situation is just kind of a case in point. We should not be surprised to see more and more of these attacks in places like Fallujah and Samarra and Ramadi, all these places around Anbar, which is where the SAWA mostly comes from.
Oh, we have to break again, Dar. When we come back, maybe you can remind listeners about the Battle of Fallujah, the two battles back in 2004. But let's take a break and we'll come right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Talking about Iraq. Dar, you were in Iraq during the two battles of Fallujah in 2004, the one in the spring and then the second one in the fall. Aside from the shock and awe in March of 2003, is it fair to say that that Fallujah fighting was probably the fiercest during the 6 years?
It's unquestioning that that's the case, where we saw, particularly in the November 2004 siege of Fallujah, that according to an Iraqi NGO working in the city, in the wake of that siege, that approximately 5,000 Iraqis were killed in that siege, and that was in roughly a 3-week period of time. So without a doubt, we haven't seen anything in the occupation that's compared to that level of violence. And let's be really clear, this was a siege launched under the pretext that a Jordanian terrorist named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was actually holding the entire city hostage. That was literally, according to one of the military commanders in charge of the situation on the ground there, right up to the beginning of that siege and during. And so it's a situation where, and you alluded to this earlier, where this is where we've seen really some of the most heinous excesses of U.S. forces in Iraq today, where we had a rampant use of white phosphorus, an incendiary weapon that was used against civilians and affected civilians, even according to the Pentagon, who later were forced to admit it. We had the use of cluster bombs, of flechettes, of depleted uranium munitions. It was really, literally, you could classify it as a massacre. And the fact that these types of weapons were used is a violation of the Geneva Conventions, because while even weapons like white phosphorus are not technically illegal by international law, they do break international law when they're used in an area where there may be civilians. And even according to the Pentagon, during the second siege of Fallujah, there were between 30 and 50,000 civilians in the city.
Well, international law is very clear, Dar, as far as a military attack against civilians. It is absolutely illegal. And when attacks are to be launched, I don't have the law in front of me right now, but I've quoted it from time to time. When an attack is to be launched in an area where civilians, any good number of civilians are thought to be, incredibly, the law says that advance warning needs to be given so the civilians will know and can get out of the way when the bombs and the shells start falling. But, of course, we simply don't give a damn. We attack, we kill many more civilians than we do so-called combatants. And the only civilians that the military is allowed to attack are the ones who take part in combat, but the ones who are simply living their lives, they just happen to be in that area for one reason or another. It is illegal to attack them, and heaven knows how many civilians we've killed in Iraq. I mean, we're getting up into massive numbers of people. It's why I call it genocide.
I think that's accurate, because we have an ongoing U.S. policy, and this becomes clear, using that terminology becomes clear, when we broaden the frame a little bit and look at U.S. involvement in Iraq for not just since March 2003, but we can go all the way back to, we can go back into the 60s and even before that, but even just starting with the Iran-Iraq War, where the U.S. was basically supporting both sides, and of course, as Henry Kissinger said at the time, let's just let them kill each other off. Going on up to the 91, George Bush's father's war against Iraq, just in that short period, killed over 100,000 people. And then if we look at the sanctions, where arguably upwards of 1 million Iraqis were killed, and really the harshest economic sanctions against any country in modern history. And then with this current situation, I mean, just with what I mentioned there alone, we're looking at well over the most conservative numbers, well over 3 million Iraqis have been killed as a direct result of U.S. policy just since 1980 alone, and we have had U.S. involvement in that country long before that time.
It's really shocking, Dad, because we're talking about a country with about 27 million people. So we're talking about something on the order of 12% of the population being wiped out, slaughtered. In U.S. population terms, population of about 300 million, that would be like an invader coming in here and slaughtering about 36 million Americans. Think of that for a second. 36 million deaths. We lost about 300,000 in World War II. Our bloodiest war was the Civil War. Both sides lost about 600,000. That in World War II population terms would have been about 12 million. Today it would probably be double that number. Civil War, that was the worst. But I mean, this mass slaughter is absolutely incredible. When it comes to Afghanistan, it's harder for some reason to come up with numbers because there's great fear that many people in Afghanistan since 2001 have died of starvation or disease, and nobody counts them, nobody pays any attention to them. So I've seen lots of numbers, and they vary all over the map. But I think we're talking about millions of people that who have died in Afghanistan since 2001. And, of course, the war is raging over there now. Oh, it just takes my breath away, Dar.
Well, it is. And it's amazing to see, this happening now and then just basically continuing on indefinitely into the future. And I think, again, it's just a matter of time before we see casualty figures for occupation forces. And I always feel a little silly talking about this because compared to the numbers of civilians being killed in both these countries, this is a minuscule amount. But unfortunately, it seems to be the only thing that people here pay attention to. And even now, that's questionable where, we're seeing days where sometimes three American soldiers are being killed in each of those occupations, and yet it seems like people continue to kind of disregard it.
As though a life, any life on either side has no meaning. Let's take another break, Darren. We'll come back and pick it back up again. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Dodger Mail on Iraq. Dar, I want people to know more about your new book. How long has it been out now?
Actually, it's going to be released on June 19th. So it's we're still a few weeks away, and actually the correct title of the book is The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And a little bit more about the book, I like to be up front because it's with the fact that this is not a book about an organized GI resistance movement, because a lot of people think, well, is this a comparison to the GI resistance movement that basically helped bring an end to the Vietnam War? And it's not, because we don't have an organized GI resistance movement, but nevertheless, we have a large subterranean, mostly unreported situation going on of a massive dissent within the ranks. I mean, we've had an 80% increase in the number of people going absent without leave since the U.S. invasion of Iraq started in March of 2003. We're looking at well over 25,000 people who have gone AWOL from the military just since March 2003, and that is by far and away the most conservative number available. We also have massive instances of what's happening in Iraq, what are referred to as search and avoid missions, which are akin to it's kind of a play on the name search and destroy mission. This is a situation that was happening during Vietnam when soldiers were becoming so disgruntled with the occupation, they decided, you know, why should we risk our lives and go out on these bogus patrols that really aren't helping anything? All we're doing is driving around waiting to get blown up. And so I've talked with dozens of soldiers who've actually been involved in these types of situations where they would literally go park their patrol of Humvees in the middle of a field, phone into their base every hour as required, and say, yes, we're still searching the field for weapons caches. We'll talk to you in another hour. I've talked to other soldiers who figured out a way to basically use computers and move the blips on the computers that represent their patrols, to use computers to move their blips around as though they're actually on patrols, when in reality they're sitting in a tea stall someplace having some tea with Iraqis. So this type of thing. We also have a situation of a dramatic increase in the number of suicides in the military, where we're setting record levels. And I think this is due to the fact that people are joining the military today more than ever based on the lies of the recruiters, which that actually is not a new component to it. But I think they've been so much more effective, that is, military recruiters, in propagandizing the situation and leading people in to join. Oh, they're going to get money for college, they're going to get to travel and see the world, etc. And then they join and become immediately disenfranchised, and the blinders are kind of pulled away from their eyes, and they see exactly what they're being used for. They're being sent directly into combat after being promised that's not going to happen to them. And so we're seeing a dramatic increase in the number of suicides, which, of course, most people wouldn't view that as resistance, but I actually refer to it in the book as sort of a resistance of desperation. When people are traumatized by war, they're stuck in the military, they're stop-loss, they don't know what else to do, and they feel like, unfortunately, this is the only option that they have left to get some relief from this situation.
Oh, indeed, it's stop-loss. Stop-loss means you sign up for a three-year hitch, and you think you're getting out, the 1st of June coming up, and then you get a set of orders saying that you've been extended for another year. And maybe another year goes by, and they say, well, you're extended for another year. So in other words, they're playing a dirty game, and they're extending people. I guess they can get away with it, Dar, but there's something rotten in Denmark about doing it. One more thing, too. You've got a lot of kids in the National Guard all over the country who signed up for the Guard with no desire in the world or ever thought in their head that they would end up being recruited into the U.S. military and sent off to fight foreign wars. They did not join the National Guard for those reasons.
Well, that's exactly right. And we're looking at a situation in Iraq where at least one-third of troops in Iraq are in the National Guard. And when you take that alone is enough to cause massive problems and dissent in the ranks. And then you throw in stop-loss, which you just mentioned. And let's be really clear with the number of people stop-loss. Since September 11, 2001, the most conservative number out there shows 142,000 people in the military have been stop-loss since that time. Some estimates now are as high as over 200,000. So this is a massive number. And think about what that does to morale. And I actually literally just posted a story yesterday for Interpress Service about a soldier down here in Texas, based at Fort Hood, who's refusing orders to deploy to Afghanistan. And part of the reason is because he had served a tour in Iraq. He was about a month away from being discharged right now. And then they say, no, we're not going to discharge you. We're about to send your unit to Afghanistan, and you're going with them. And so he's refusing to go, and that's part of the reason. Again, the military reneging on all of these promises. But let's be really clear that all of these factors are what's contributing to a rise of dissent in the ranks, where people, you know, who, especially National Guard types, these are people with their own businesses, they have families, they have commitments, and the government is basically making it completely impossible for them to fulfill any of those aforementioned commitments. And so, it doesn't take long to see why there is dissent, why people are upset. They're tired of being lied to. They sign contracts. The government's breaking those contracts. And that is really the foundation of why we're seeing so many different types of resistance across the military. The only thing is it's not getting hardly any press because it's not organized. It's not all with one organization. But that doesn't hide the fact, that doesn't stop the fact that we have more and more people than ever now that are going AWOL. They're speaking up. They're filing lawsuits against the military in a myriad of different ways. They're starting to resist.
I just pulled up something that I wrote some time back where I quoted from the U.S. Army Field Manual 2710. It incorporates the principles, the Nuremberg principles, other international law as well, the law of land warfare that was dated 1956. Just a couple of quick things from it. Paragraph 498 says that any person, military or civilian, who commits a crime under international law is responsible for it and may be punished. And another paragraph, 499, defines a war crime. There's no ambiguity about what a war crime is. You can go through so much international law, Geneva Conventions are about as good as any, U.S. law, U.N. Resolutions, U.N. Law, the U.N. Charter. You could go to so much and find out what a war crime is or a crime against humanity. There's a paragraph 500 that refers to conspiracy, attempts to commit it, and complicity with respect to international crimes. Another paragraph denies the defense of superior orders in commission of a crime. You can't say, my commander ordered me to do it, so, you know, I couldn't disobey an order. That does not cut it, according to the U.S. Army Field Manual alone, let alone international law. And it goes on and on and on. Observing this field manual, these soldiers have a perfect right to refuse to commit an illegal act. But at the same time, the military can go after them, and they may or may not get a conviction. I saw your article on the Fort Hood soldier. I guess there's a very good possibility he'll face a court-martial. I hope he will get himself a good lawyer who will defend him, and it's possible that he may come out of this okay.
Well, he has good lawyers, and he's actually demanding a court-martial because he wants to use his case to bring more attention to what is happening of all of this that we've just discussed. And he's hoping that he will set an example that more people will follow of refusing orders. And, of course, the shining example of all of this, as I know you're familiar with, Stephen, is Aaron Watada, which we just also had recent news just less than a couple of weeks ago. This is the highest-ranking enlisted person in the military to date to refuse orders to go to Iraq. He did that. He was court-martialed. The judge blew the trial. There cannot be double jeopardy. And now here's the situation where, while the military has tied his hands for a while and kind of kept him relegated to a desk job, at the end of the day, here's the highest-ranking member of the military to refuse orders to deploy to the illegal occupation of Iraq, and he will not spend one day in Iraq, and he will not spend one day in jail.
Oh, it's a famous case. It made a lot of headlines. And, a couple of others, too. Kapil Mejia, his case. Now, I think he was sentenced, wasn't he, a year in prison or so?
He ended up doing about 9 months in prison. This was the first conscientious objector to the war. He, after serving a tour in Iraq, he saw what was going on and turned vehemently opposed to the occupation and came back and again was court-martialed, spent 9 months in jail. He was a prisoner of conscience, according to Amnesty International, but what has been released, of course, and discharged from the military. And from that point on, he has been one of the really leading the charge of GI resistors who are refusing to participate in the occupation of Iraq.
It's a shame that we don't get stories about this, even a few that are in the major media. Of course, this is stuff that they would want to say absolutely nothing about. Also, the fact that the kind of people they recruit into the military, given that the dire economic times we're going through right now, it's made recruiting easier for the military. But they recruit a lot of poor kids who really are looking for a way to bring in an income. And if you can't find a civilian job, then you just may end up opting for what you can get. So they're taking a lot of kids, many of them who wouldn't be recruited otherwise, including those that may not have reading skills or other skills, foreign nationals, even so-called undocumented immigrants who they make promises to but may not keep their promises. Anything to get kids into the ranks and send them into the meat grinder of a war zone. And these kids, as you say, they're sold a bill of goods, and they don't realize what they're getting themselves into until they're shipped off to Iraq or Afghanistan. And these are pretty ugly places.
And I'm convinced right now, Stephen, that really the key component to keeping this whole thing going right now has been the economic crisis here at home. That up until this economic crisis really got into full swing, the military, all branches of the military, were not making their recruiting goals. That's why we saw them raise the allowable enlistment age to 40, all these massive signing bonuses, re-enlisting bonuses. I mean, the military was spending millions and millions of dollars to keep this going, spending over $1 billion a year just on recruiting propaganda alone. But what turned that all around and began once again to swell the ranks of the military was this economic crisis, where literally we see people, and I've talked to a lot of these people myself, who say, look, I'm from small town in the middle of nowhere in the United States, and my choices for jobs are either Walmart, McDonald's, or the military, so guess which one I'm going to choose.
Oh, indeed, and it's not always a sure thing. Walmart and McDonald's and so on, they only need so many people, and the unemployment rate is absolutely, it's really off the charts because it's far, far higher than the official reported numbers. The numbers leaching out, we talk about this on the program all the time, there are 500,000-600,000 officially reported unemployed, adding to the unemployed rolls every month. But the true numbers run more like 800,000 to a million, and the Labor Department calls it U3 unemployment, 8.9%, a number that's never reported in the major media. The Labor Department's so-called U6 unemployment rate is really closer to around 15 or 16%. Then you get some independent economic analysts who do some additional figuring, and with all categories counted, including the so-called part-timers who may work as little as 1 hour in a month, they're considered employed, involuntary part-timers or whatever, discouraged workers, people who keep looking, and then if they happen to turn up in a survey and they hadn't been looking in the last 30 days, they're called unemployed. And that number may be approaching or may even have passed 20%. So there's a lot of cannon fodder out there for the military to pick up there.
Well, that's exactly right, and that is a big problem. And again, this doesn't change the fact that we still have a very large number of people in the military who are dissenting and resisting in what ways they can to participate in both of these occupations and other military activities around the globe. But at the same time, as you said, that is really what's perpetuating. That's what's keeping it going as the economic situation continues to sour, as it does and as it will. The military will have plenty of these people. So it's a very complicated time where, on one hand, we're seeing actually, I think, more dissent than ever in the military, but simultaneously we're seeing more people join the military now than have in at least since March 2003, if not for years before then. So it's interesting in that all of this is happening simultaneously, and I think, again, it's going to take more people, more citizens in the United States tuning into what's actually happening and start to take action, real action, not just calling their elected representatives or writing letters to their senators or this kind of thing, but doing things like protesting, going into and really getting involved with groups who are going to go into their representative's office and basically make it impossible for them to carry out their job unless they start respecting the demands of their constituency. Because right now, all the poll numbers show that the vast majority of the people in this country, well over 60% at this point, oppose the continuance of the occupation of Iraq. And we're now seeing, for the first time, increasing numbers of people who are starting to turn against Afghanistan. And, of course, this isn't being reported in the corporate media, but it's important to know that if you oppose these occupations, especially the occupation of Iraq, you are in concert with the vast majority of the people in this country. You're not the embattled minority that those people were during the first couple of years of the occupation. And that is really the tide of sentiment that really swept Barack Obama into the office of the presidency. But now we have a government that's once again, instead of really changing the situation for the better by withdrawing, just simply continuing on Bush policy in both of these countries. And so I think it's important for people to really keep in mind that, you know, the fight is not over. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's really just kind of entered this new phase where, okay, now we have a new type of governmental propaganda to overcome. But the reality is the actions opposing both these occupations really, really can't stop. If anything, right now at this particular time, it should be increasing.
And I think also that during this time of a very grave economic crisis, a topic that we keep going back to all the time on this program, we will again tomorrow and Friday. We have terrible growing deprivation at home. And yet we're pouring, aside from the trillions of dollars we're giving to bankers, we shouldn't give them 10 cents. We're giving trillions of dollars to them. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on these two horrible wars that we never should be fighting. And we're letting our own people here in this country be deprived. Poverty is growing greatly. Unemployment is growing greatly. People are losing their homes. They're losing their savings. I talk about they're losing their futures, and the only thing the Obama administration has done, I refer to as crumbs. The programs, the so-called stimulus, makes headlines, but people don't look beneath the surface and see exactly what is going on, how much is being allocated to help people in grave need. Very, very little is being done, and yet we're spending all of this money on all these other things. This is the way people should view it, that we're being cheated, and we need to do something about it. We need to change this. Oh, we need to take our final break there, and then we'll come back, and I'll let you finish up with final thoughts. We'll be right back. Segment with Dodger Mail. There are a couple of comments and I'll let you finish up. I get headlines that pop up on my desktop all the time. And here's one that a roadside bomb kills a U.S. soldier in Baghdad. And then a bigger one, a car bombing kills 30 in Pakistan. That's the spillover of the Afghan war that has got Pakistan, the border area between the two countries. It's got that area embroiled in it. So you've really got the Afghan-Pakistan war going on. And again, brought to you by the good folks who represent us in Washington and their military arm and the Pentagon. Or maybe I've got that in reverse. Maybe it's the Pentagon with their partners in Washington. But, people need to know about your website. And I think the easiest way to find it, and they can sign up for your alerts, is to do what I do. I just Google a name, so I Google your name and can bring you up anytime. Dahr, D-A-H-R, Jamail, J-A-M-A-I-L, but it's Dodger Mail's Mideast Dispatches, and your website is DodgerMailIraq.com. Have I got that right?
It's true, and I actually have another domain that's much simpler. It's simply dahr.org, D-A-H-R.org, and folks can go there, and I am posting stories on a weekly basis, sometimes two a week, and folks can sign up for the dispatches. It's free, and I have literally everything I've ever written from Iraq. Every hard news story, reports, et cetera, are on the website with photos and a multimedia section and a pretty broad link section. So folks, because I consistently get asked, well, where can we get better information about what's happening abroad? And so I have a pretty broad link section that have alternative media sources as well as a lot of foreign media sources that I like to use to stay up on things over there as well.
Well, there's nobody who has done more heroic reporting on Iraq legitimately than you have, Dahr. And you went over there. You were there in a war zone. You risked your neck, and you produced so much good journalism where the so-called major media reporters were embedded, protected by the U.S. military or whatever. And, of course, they just put out the party line. But A little bit more about your book. I'm going to let you get the title because I guess I didn't list it right. Military Resistance, but your book, and it'll be out June 19th. And give the full title again, Doc.
Yeah, the book is called The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. It is going to be released June 19th. So if your bookstore doesn't have it, they certainly can order it for you. And it's a rather extensive survey of the types of dissent happening in the military as a result of both of these ongoing occupations and for a lot of the reasons that you and I have just discussed. And it should give people a very idea of a much clearer picture of what is happening in the military, how both these occupations are affecting the military, literally breaking it down from the inside out as both of these continue indefinitely. It's a book of stories directly from the soldiers' mouths themselves. I really took myself out of the book and just let the soldiers speak for themselves and interviewed dozens of people to give people a very clear idea of how these occupations are literally doing as some people in Congress had warned long ago. They're literally breaking down the military, and this is a book that gives people an inside perspective on how and why that's happening.
Darn, that's in the tradition of a great Chicagoan who died not too many months back, Studs Terkel, who wrote so many glorious books, and they really were histories of the people that he interfaced with, whether he was talking about World War II or the poor or whatever his topic was. And he wrote so many books with that, and he was the master of that kind of history. And this is the kind of book, it sounds like you've done the same thing with regard to soldiers who resist the kind of fighting they never should be asked to do in the first place. It sounds like a terrific book, Derek.
Well, thank you, Stephen, and I definitely look forward to talking to more people about it and appreciate, again, you having me on your show.
Oh, Derek, I want to get you back all the time so we can continue this. That music means they're going to break away, so I've only got time to thank you for coming on again. And let me leave you saying to be continued, because this Iraq war in Afghanistan, they are not going away. They will be with us. And, Dara, I appreciate your coming on to update listeners.